Tom Woods Show, episode 891.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you men out there, it's time to graduate from the $99 clearance rack at Sears. Get a made-to-measure suit from Indochino, and heads will turn. This week, my listeners can get 50% off a made-to-measure suit. That's just $389 at Indochino.com when you use code WOODS. Folks, we're capitalists on this show, and we're not ashamed of that. And one of the easiest places to be a capitalist is on the internet. So, for example, if you've got a website and you're not monetizing it, then you're a schmuck. I'm going to show you what I'm doing exactly, step by step, in this free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Our old friend Gene Epstein returns to the show. Gene, of course, is economics and book review editor for Barron's, the nation's premier financial publication. He also runs the Soho Forum, which is an incredible debating society in New York City. It succeeds the Junto, which closed its doors actually not long after Michael Malice and I had our debate on Alexander Hamilton. How were they going to top that, right? So they closed their doors. But it's been more or less replaced by the Soho Forum. And I strongly urge you, if you're in New York City, to check that out. They have an interesting debate every single month. And it's exciting because it's one of these Oxford-style debates where you poll the audience beforehand, and then you poll the audience after the debate. You see which side changed more minds, and then you have an objective winner. A lot of fun. It's one of the great benefits of living in New York City. You can check it out at thesohoforum.org. And, of course, Gene is at barons.com. The topic of our discussion today is what we read in the March report of the Congressional Budget Office about the fiscal projections for the U.S., and it's not looking good. But yet we always hear this, oh, it's not looking good, it's not looking good, and yet nothing really seems to happen. So we want to talk about what is likely to happen. What does it mean for the United States to be on a fiscal path to hell, as Gene calls it? What does that actually look like? What are the nuts and bolts of this? And that's what we want to talk about today. Margaret Thatcher famously said, "The problem with socialism is that you eventually run out of other people's money." And Gene tells me he would have rendered that as a problem of the welfare warfare state is that you eventually run out of other people's money. A problem, because that's obviously not the only problem with the welfare warfare state, but that's the problem we're going to be talking about today. Gene, welcome back.
Tom, it's a pleasure to be back at one of my favorite shows. In fact, I think you deserve the Lou Gehrig Award or the Ted Williams Award for the highest batting average of any libertarian show, five times a week and then once a week with Murphy. Incredibly great stuff. So it's an honor to be back.
That's very kind, although I sure hope I'm batting more than 400. For the episodes, but but all the same, I get your point. Okay,
good point, Tom. Yeah, you know, adjusted.
I think
you're
batting,
right. Maybe 900, Tom. 900,
that's right.
But I'm not giving you 1,000, Tom. I'm too tough a critic.
Well, you know, it would be fun to have a drunk episode where you and I have a few drinks, then we talk about the ones you didn't like. That would be an episode right there. All right, let's talk about the Congressional Budget Office, which issues warnings about the fiscal path of the U.S. that go ignored every time they come out.
Yeah.
But they just issued their report recently. You wrote about it in Barron's, and they're saying that the U.S. is on the road to either the fiscal road to hell or the road to fiscal hell.
Yeah.
But the thing is, now, let me just, before you even get to the meat of that, why can't I say legitimately, oh, here we go again. We constantly hear this, and then nothing actually happens. You know, we manage to struggle along. So why should I care at this point? Yeah. I'll be dead before this even matters. Well, why should I care?
Well, you'll probably be alive and kicking. It's a 30-year projection, and actually, I'm 72, but I plan to exceed 100, so I'll probably be alive then as well. And of course, the answer is that we are indeed in a period of the calm before the storm. The Congressional Budget Office is only saying that the road we are on You use a few simple assumptions about economic growth, about the rise in elder care entitlements, about the rising debt and the potential for interest rates to go back to normal. Those interesting little points, they're only saying year after year that 15, 20 years from now, we run the risk of a very serious fiscal crisis, that the debt to GDP ratio is going to exceed the post-World War II highs, and it will continue to rise, nowhere to go but up. And they keep citing their 2010 study, comparing the U.S. with Greece and Argentina, and showing that there are indeed uncomfortable parallels. And so, when Hayek wrote The Road to Serfdom, he didn't, many misinterpreted him to mean that he thought the road to serfdom was inevitable. For you and I are radicals, Tom, and we know that nothing is inevitable. We know that history, that the future is a series of choices, and that it's very possible that this road to hell will not occur. But the reason I think that the SIBO is right to point out that the dangers are very great, that the U.S. is on the road to hell, is that, and of course, they're an establishment, nonpartisan organization based in Washington. They are good Keynesians, not bad Keynesians. And by the way, I want to get to that distinction, why they are good Keynesians and why, for example, Paul Krugman is a bad Keynesian. They are only pointing out that there is very substantial cause for concern, and that also that that this is no way to run a budget. This is no way for the federal government to operate, running the serious risk of causing a major fiscal crisis in the economy, and that in particular, if they are making promises to Tom Woods at the age of 44 that all his entitlements are going to be ready for him when he turns 65 and 70, that it's not good policy to suddenly pull the plug on these old people because you suddenly can't afford it. We can potentially, to speak like a wonk, we could potentially end welfare as we know it for 30-year-olds, but you can't end entitlements as elderly people know it when they're 65 and 70. That's the reason why it's prudent to take steps right now to avoid this crisis. So again, the baby boomers have not yet reached critical mass. The deficits are chronic, but they are not at this point so severe. We are now at the debt to GDP ratio, public debt held by the public, that is treasury debt held by the public, of which half is held abroad, by the way, is running now about 77% of gross domestic product. And now if we can keep it at 77%, then we can scrape by. But they point out that the road we are on is such that in 30 years, it could be anywhere from 150% of GDP to 220% and still rise. And that runs the risk of a fiscal crisis. So they are prudently warning us before the devastation starts to start being aware of this problem and taking steps to remedy it.
Now, obviously, the major ingredients here are Social Security and Medicare, but Medicare dwarfs Social Security in significance on this. And yet, yes. I think from conservative wonks, I usually hear more about Social Security for some reason.
That's absolutely right. And by the way, it's essentially, that's a point that that Paul Krugman has made among the vast wasteland of his many problems and objections to the SIBO's projections. He keeps saying that Social Security is not such a problem. And he's absolutely right, by the way, that if Social Security were the only elder care program, then it could be absorbed. But, of course, the key to that is that in 1965, Social Security was supposed to pay for the medical care of old people and the nursing home care, and then they created Medicare. And, by the way, it's not just Medicare, it's also Medicaid, because Medicaid pays a substantial amount to old people, in particular, their nursing home costs. And so it's mainly Medicare and Medicaid. And Medicare and Medicaid were then broken off from Social Security, and that makes Social Security look good. But that's just, that was just essentially a ploy. Then Medicare and Medicaid began to lead a life of their own, and they began to explode. And so, of course, the CBO keeps pointing out that it's a combination of all of these programs. Essentially, we could call it elder care. But Krugman and others are being hypnotized by the fact that the government puts different labels and puts in different buckets in way its way of taking care of old people. And so, again, it doesn't mean it means nothing. I mean, Krugman has actually written that there's no one problem. There's only several problems. Obviously, it's all a part of the same bucket, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and of course, to some degree as well, Obamacare, which we haven't yet abolished. And that's the point that the CBO is making. And then, of course, when it comes to trying to fix the problem, we can fix it in a wonkish way, which I did, by the way. I wrote an article, a cover story for Barron's, in December, in which I said there's a way to cut $8.6 trillion from the federal budget over the next 10 years. And if you apply that $8.6 trillion to the CBO's baseline estimate, then my $8.6 trillion could balance the budget by 2024. Now, that included, by the way, $1 trillion of cuts in military spending. Just, get rid of those ridiculous bases in places like Germany and Japan, since World War II ended quite a while ago. You know, there are various things that you actually can do. And, of course, now Social Security, go for all the low-hanging fruit. In the case of Social Security, for example, accelerate the retirement age. You know, the retirement age, which now is goes to 62 to 70. People are living far longer. You know, all of those prudent things can be done if you simply play the wonkish game. But unfortunately, the CBO, by the way, keeps issuing a huge report on cuts you could apply to the budget and other things you could do. And of course, these things are constantly ignored. So again, the road to hell, by the way, of course, that phrase was used by Douglas Holtz Eakin, who had been director of the CBO. He's, it's only when he left the CBO that he used a non-wonkish term like a road to hell. You know, the CBO, of course, talks in more more bureaucratic terms about the serious risk of a fiscal crisis and all the rest of it. But of course, it's obviously, again, the road to hell. It's not inevitable, but if you've studied public choice theory, if you understand what politicians are all about, then unfortunately, the road to hell begins to look fairly likely. It begins to look like it's a very plausible scenario. And by the way, I do want to file this point that over the Passover weekend, I had an opportunity to spend a lot of hours in the car with one of the with somebody who appeared on your show recently, Jim Epstein, who spoke about Bitcoin and also about virtual currency generally. And he made the point to me that he's my son, as you revealed, and he made the point to me that that the response on the part of the Federal Reserve, the central bank, when the debt does begin to get out of hand, will probably be to print money, to print their way out of it. It's a natural, inevitable response of government. And that, by the way, I'll tell you another irony, that those who have pushed back against my articles on this subject constantly say, how can you compare the U.S. with Greece? Greece had to pay its debt in euros. The U.S. debt is denominated in dollars, and even though half of it is owed to the Chinese, the Japanese, to other foreigners, that all they need to do, or the U.S. will never default. It just will print the money, print the dollars in order to pay that debt. And they're probably right. What they don't realize, of course, is that that could bring a monetary and hyperinflation crisis that could cause even even worse problems. It could cause the dollar to collapse. It could cause an even worse fiscal crisis, as it might indeed do. But Jim Epstein points out that at least there's a silver lining to that. There are those who point out, well, will there be a rush into gold if the dollar is collapsing? Well, will there be a rush into the Chinese currency, the yuan? No, there might be a new kind of safe haven. There might be the virtual currency. Perhaps it will be Bitcoin, or perhaps it will be one of the offshoots of Bitcoin. That could be a very happy outcome out of this very, very wrenching fiscal crisis.
I think it's going to be hard for the Fed to use inflationary monetary policy to solve a problem like this. Because
really?
It'd be one thing to solve a problem where you want to pay for infrastructure and it's a one-shot deal. But these are programs that are supposed to pay out year after year after year.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with an inflation policy, as you know, is not simply that prices will rise and we'll suffer from that. It's that for the Fed to be able to credibly do this, this is the problem. If the Fed starts inflating and we believe that this is not just a one-shot deal, but this is going to be a consistent policy, then we start anticipating still higher prices, which means we start in the here and now bidding prices up, which now makes the Fed want to increase the money supply even more to compensate for that.
Yes.
And then it's, you know, Katie bar the door at that point. So that's going to be hard for them to do.
Well,
now,
okay. I want to respond to your question, Tom, but let me just counter. First of all, you know, exactly how this scenario will play out. On the one hand, there are the Krugmans who argue, well, it doesn't really have to happen, and we could deal with that.
Right.
But then you're saying, okay, let's say it does happen. How will it play out? Let me just make two points to you that, ironically, I can invoke Alan Greenspan and Milton Friedman. Alan Greenspan wrote in his book, The Age of Turbulence, the book he wrote after he left the Fed in great glory for having been a great Fed chairman, which soon unraveled, but he wrote that he is really fearful that by the 2030s, inflation is going to rear its ugly head big time, and that we will have a repeat of the 1970s, which culminated in the deep recession of the early 80s. He made two points. He said, first of all, the very point that the Fed will be under pressure to monetize an exploding debt, and second, he pointed out that the disinflation tendencies, which I believe are valid. And when I talk in those terms, people think I'm forgetting that inflation is a monetary fund. The disinflation tendencies of cheap labor abroad will have been played out. And the other point is the Milton Friedman point, which is the depressing point, which is that the lessons of economic and financial and monetary history often are not learned. And so I could say to you, well, you know, it happened in the 1970s, the same folly. And you might say, well, didn't we learn from that folly? You know, well, yes and no. Oftentimes the lessons of the past are forgotten. So my point is that the U.S. Economy was running double-digit inflation, 10%, 11%, 12%, and it was up potentially on that road to inflationary hell until Volcker came along and hiked the interest rate to 22% and broke the back of the inflation and broke the back of the economy. I say that could happen again. That folly could happen again. I could be wrong, but I believe potentially you are being naive in imagining that those who run the Fed by 2030 aren't going to be just as naive as those who ran the Fed in the 1970s. So that's my counter, but go ahead with your question.
All right, I'll give you my question after we pause to thank our sponsor. When you're wearing a suit, you're trying to look your best, and one way to screw that up is to be wearing a suit that doesn't quite fit right. Well, how can you make sure your suit does fit right and you look like somebody who's totally in command rather than some clueless loser? The answer is to get a made-to-measure suit. Indochino is one of the largest made-to-measure menswear brands. They'll make you a high-quality suit to your exact measurements. You can customize the suit just the way you want it. It's easy to do online, as I can tell you from personal experience. You will feel like the master of the universe. And what's more, you don't have to pay a fortune. This week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $389 at Indochino.com when you enter Woods at checkout. Plus, you don't pay nothing for shipping. $389 and free shipping. That's Indochino.com using promo code WOODS. Well, as it turns out, my question comes courtesy of Paul Krugman.
Oh, yes.
I was looking through his writing on this subject and on Kotlikoff. And Kotlikoff, who Larry Kotlikoff of Boston University,
yes,
is, of course, the guy we associate with these gigantic numbers relating to the unfunded liabilities. And apparently he and Krugman have had it out.
Oh, really?
He actually wrote a piece to the New York Times where he said, look, Paul, you know, I actually think you're a pretty good economist and everything, but stop calling people stupid. It's really just beneath you, and what? So it was pretty good to see that. But anyway,
yeah, I know.
But Krugman was saying, look, I get what Kotlikoff is trying to calculate. The problem is what he comes up with are these unimaginably large numbers, and then he declares America bankrupt.
Yeah.
He says, look, that's silly, because the U.S. economy is also expected to grow a lot in the future, and meanwhile, real interest rates are expected to be only slightly above growth rates. So any persistent gap between spending and revenues as a percentage of GDP will be a huge number if converted to present values. But bear in mind, you're going to have a much, much larger U.S. economy in the future. Isn't that accounted for by Kotlikoff or not?
Well, you know, I think so. Let me just say a couple of things about that, just a short circuit. I do believe that Larry Kotlikoff, to some small degree, is leaning with his chin when he structures the argument in that way. I know him. I had a long conversation with him. I do like to quote his line that, you know, if there used to be the greatest generation, the baby boomers are now the greediest generation. You know, he's put some good phrases into the language, and I think his exercise about taking the debt and then making a present value calculation may well be not necessarily factoring in economic growth. I'm not sure. I found that again, if Larry Kotlikoff wants to push back and demand that I retract this, I did find that he just kept telling me. I kept telling him that I think that this present value calculation has some usefulness. There's a guy named Jagadish Gokhale, for example, who used to be at Cato, is now at Wharton, who's a student of his, who likes to do these calculations. I told Jagadish, and then I told Kotlikoff, that I think that the Congressional Budget Office method is far better. They try to tell a story. They don't do a present value calculation where there's a lot of sort of complicated stuff embedded in it. The Congressional Budget Office lays it out. The Congressional Budget Office, of course, is assuming that economic growth will continue. So that when I said that they project that the debt could grow to anywhere from 150% of nominal GDP to 220% by 2030, and that this would way exceed, it was at 106% in 1946, just after World War II, and then it fell very steadily into the 1950s. Their point is, not only will it way exceed the ratio, this is uncharted waters, will it way exceed the ratio of 106%, it's going to continue to rise. 30 years from now, the projections are it will still have nowhere to go but up. So that is the source of their concern. And they are laying out their assumptions. They are saying that they're projecting real GDP growing at 1.9% average for the next 30 years. That's the assumption they are making. So clearly, that's, you know, that now Krugman can then argue with that 1.9 assumption, and that nominal GDP will grow by 4% over the next 30 years. And so that's laid out very explicitly so that we simple-minded people, reasonably simple-minded people, can put our mind around it. So, okay, again, all I'm really saying, Tom, is that it's difficult for me to step up to the plate and defend Kotlikoff. He then said to me that he doesn't see that there's even any merit in the CBO's exercise, that somehow or other his calculations are more scientific. I don't see that. I think that his calculations aren't the best way to go, even though, of course, you could do a present value calculation if you want to and come up with a scary number. But the point is that the CBO, I think, is making it more user-friendly and saying, well, Krugman, if you want to object, you want to object to what the SIBO is saying. And by the way, there, his Krugman has had a whole history of slightly crazy statements. I guess what you and Tom Murphy were recently mentioning, that at one point he was accusing the SIBO of being highly politicized. I mean, the truth is that since 2006, the SIBO has been issuing these warnings. And pretty consistently, it doesn't matter who's been in charge. And then they wrote the 2010 paper on the fiscal crisis, and they keep citing it. And that's whoever has been in charge. And that's, I think they've gone through three directorships at least over the last 10 years, because the numbers stare you in the face. So, all right, let's at least skirt that and try to address Krugman and say, look, Krugman, read the Congressional Budget Office report. And what he does, again, is a long trail of fallacies that he trots out. He sometimes cherry picks a number and says that the SIBO, it's pretty good news. Or actually, I guess his worst moment is that he sometimes acknowledges, sometimes he calls the projections scary projections, as indeed they are. But then he keeps saying, oh, we don't have to really do anything about it now. We do have to cut carbon emissions. That's what another column is. We've got to cut carbon emissions to avoid global warming, even though, of course, the poor people of the world are going to starve if we do that, and even though there's no way to cut carbon emissions without impoverishing us. But we don't have to do anything about the fiscal debt now. We can wait 15, 20 years and then see what happens. I mean, again, a totally myopic statement on Krugman's part, because, again, you cannot ask elderly people to run risks with their future. You cannot make these promises that you're going to pay for their Medicare and Social Security and pension and nursing home care, and then suddenly declare 10, 15 years from now, oh, it looks like we can't afford it. And you can, and when he writes, the politicians of the future can be left to this, well, what have the politicians of the present been doing? And how naive can you be about politicians who can only look to the next election and obviously don't give a damn what's going to happen 10, 15 years from now. So I'm just giving you an overview of Krugman's inability to wrestle with the SIBO's assumptions. But getting back specifically to your question, the SIBO is saying 1.9% average growth in GDP over the next 30 years and 4% nominal. Let's focus on the 1.9%. They point out that over the last 30 years, growth has run 2.5% average. And they're saying it's going to be 1.9%. Well, in fact, over the last 15 years, growth has run 1.9%. And of course, that included the Great Recession. But I believe that 1.9% is a reasonable projection given what's in store, given the fact that the debt is going to slow growth, given the fact that demographically, we're not going to have the baby boomers entering the labor force or women entering the labor force as we did in the 1990s. So I believe that 1.9% is pretty good. Does Krugman want to goose it up to 2.1 or 2.2? You know, that's what the SIBO does. You don't get a very different result. So the point is, again, the SIBO is making prudent assumptions, and Krugman, by going after Kotlikoff and making this point about economic growth, is simply choosing not to read the source that constantly publishes on this issue and that directly addresses his concerns.
Yeah, let me jump in on this. So sure. I was going to raise as an objection that Krugman raises that all of the things that either Kotlikoff or the CBO are saying assume that policy won't change in the meantime.
Right.
But that's a fair assumption.
Yes.
If it hasn't changed up to now, it's not going to change. You know, so there's no reason to think that's going to change. But the other thing is, I agree with you that another reason that it's reasonable to say 1.9% growth is that there's another factor weighing on the economy.
Yeah.
You mentioned demographics. Well, it's not just, of course, that we're not having as many younger people entering. It's we have so many older people exiting.
Yeah.
And the older folks are older, they don't work, or they don't work as effectively, and they cost a lot more money. I'm just being blunt and just being honest, because we're not children here. We can discuss this, and that
is good. Tommy, you haven't insulted me. Go ahead.
Exactly. Right. Nor should I. So that is necessarily going to drag down growth. Now, there could be some continued burst, you know, like Internet 2.0 or something could revolutionize our lives in some way that I can't anticipate. But barring that, I don't think it's crazy to say 1.9. So Krugman will then say, well, even if what these crazy people are saying is true, and yeah, we do stay on the same trajectory and we do hit this really, really big fiscal speed bump. Okay, so we'll, at that point, we'll make some cuts and we'll make some adjustments, but it's not that like we're bankrupt or anything. So I think, again, he's trying to downplay. Yeah. Describe for me then, in contra what Krugman is saying, if I may use that phrase, how this is going to look, how what the kind of wrenching changes we could be facing would actually look like.
Yeah. Well, Krugman has very glibly, I mean, at least, you know, I now happily get my Krugman columns from listening to Contra Krugman every week.
It's the only way to get them.
You guys avoid me. I've got you guys to help me because I still get, you know, email from readers asking me to read Krugman and tell me what his problem is. And I got you guys to speed that process for me. Maybe I haven't read everything, but Krugman has made just sort of vague allusions to the idea, you know, let the government deal with it, you know, 10, 15 years from now, you know, and the SIBO points out that, of course, the more you delay, the higher the debt grows, the higher the interest cost on the debt grows. So by the way, the interest cost on the debt, you know, we now, of course, the calm before the storm is indeed that we're at these ridiculously low interest rates. The SIBO very prudently says, by the way, that they're projecting that the average interest rate cost on the Treasury debt is now 2%, and that's 2% right now, the average interest rate servicing on the debt, and it used to be over the last 20 years, it was 6%. So we're now 4 percentage points below what it used to be at 6%. That was the cost of servicing the debt. And the SIBO projects a very slow rise to a high of 4.8%. So they don't think, and the average will be about 3 to 4%. But even with those very, very modest assumptions, they're pointing out that the debt servicing alone at the rate we're going is going to run one-third, nearly a third of all projected revenue. It's going to start. The debt servicing, the cost of the interest on the debt, is going to explode. So the point is that as each year goes on, the choices get worse and worse. The need to suddenly hike taxes by unheard of amounts, that in itself is going to bring a wrench. The need to dramatically cut elder care entitlements rather than creeping them up, that's going to be a wrench. Do we have 2, 3, 5, 6 years to go? Or indeed, have others, including the SIBO, including me, have we tried to talk about remedies? As I just mentioned, I wrote a report saying here, and with the Cato wonks, by the way, supporting me and giving me the numbers, I showed a way to achieve a balanced budget with projected growth of the SIBO's baseline in 8 years, and to reduce the debt to GDP ratio from 77% to the 50% range, which is still quite high, so that you could avoid this. But again, the point is that as the SIBO keeps repeating, you have to give people time to plan their lives. Maybe, I get, obviously, Tom Woods at the age of 44, after listening to Epstein and others, knows that he can't plan his life around the assumption that he's going to have all these entitlements showered on him by the time he's 70, but a lot of other people are planning their lives around it. And so it's only prudent to start, on the part of the federal government, to start avoiding this risk right now, because it is of great dangerous risk. Go for the low-hanging fruit. I didn't even, by the way, in my 8.6%, 8.6 trillion of cuts, I didn't even abolish Medicaid, abolish Medicare. I talked about, you know, Medicare alone, for example, projects that its own projection is that 12% of Medicare payments are fraudulent. And so for example, now obviously you could say this is an easy statement. I said, let's assume that they're able to police their program enough so they can cut the fraudulent rate in half to 6%, which is still pretty bad. But So that was one of my low-hanging fruits. You know, that'll save. So the calculations you could reach were just, you know, all the tally that I came up with, added up to after a while to a considerable sum. Of course, then I said, you know, do we really need a Department of Education? You know, the founding fathers must be turning over their grave. Let's phase it out. Let's shut that down, you know. Do we need, I think I didn't even throw in that, do we really need a Department of Energy? Do we really need, you know, all of these crazy things that come. You know, you might say, you know, God, isn't it easy? You know, there's so many ridiculous things that government is spending its money on, but they don't go away, you know. And of course, mine was, you know, I began, by the way, by quoting, our great President Trump, by, you know, he said, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse. Everywhere you look, it's waste, fraud, and abuse. I'm going to cut so much it'll make your head spin. So I wrote, let the head spinning begin, you know, but let's not have any political spinning about whether we're really cutting, you know. But obviously, it does not look as though President Trump is going to be cutting that much waste, fraud, and abuse. So again, going back to Krugman, just put a fine point on Krugman's point, I would like to see him look at the SIBO projections and then tell us why he wants to wait. Looks as though he wants to wait until about 2030, when the debt to GDP ratio will likely be over 100, when the deficits are going to be running, when $1 trillion a year deficits are going to be on the low side. At that point, what kind of stops? What is he going to expect from our heroic statesman-like politicians in 2030 that will cure this problem, so that old people who are planning on these benefits can have time to plan their lives around the new assumptions? What could he possibly do? It doesn't seem very likely that he can do anything. All he can really do is pray. You know, we can pray, you know, as you just said, you know, we can pray for 3% and 4% growth. You know, you and I, you know, we're Austrians. We don't predict the future in the way that others do. If growth really accelerates, then that could make a difference. That could really, postpone the day. I will say one thing, by the way, going back to Kotlikoff and Gokhale, the one criticism they make of the SIBO's study is indeed a valid one. Basically, it's this, that the factors, that even though the demographic time bomb is beginning to explode, it won't reach full force for another 10 years. But their point is that the SIBO's other assumptions, which is that medical care per capita is increasing faster than GDP per capita, that it has been doing so for a long time, and the SIBO prudently cuts it down, but they say it's foolish to imagine that's not going to continue. They also point out, obviously, that the interest rate on the debt is going to so explode that it's going to start, that in itself is going to start eating up the debt. And Gokhale and Kotlikoff point out that those two factors are not going to stop. And 30 years from now, as the SIBO, of course, adds in a footnote, an afterthought, the debt is going to continue to rise. So they say, why cut it off 30 years from now? If these factors are going to continue to stare us in the face, most likely, and therefore we really do face a problem that's not going to stop in 30 years. So again, the key point is that while the baby boomer explosion is exacerbating the problem, the other two reasons for fearing the explosion of the debt are going to persist beyond 2030, so that there is enough. So if you're a prudent steward of the U.S. budget and of the U.S. economy, the idea of listening to Krugman and saying, well, après moi le deluge, let's wait for those politicians in 2030 to do something about that, that's imprudent, irresponsible behavior. And it's really, I don't even know if Krugman really means it. It's just that he flails every time he looks at the SIBO numbers and desperately tries for some reason to deny them, because Because if you're going to start acknowledging the SIBO numbers, then a lot of other things have to follow. You know, Douglas Holtz-Eakin, by the way, talked about the road to hell when Obamacare had come out. He said, Obamacare, he said, isn't it insane? We're on the road to hell, and now we're crazy enough to add yet another entitlement that's going to put us even faster on the road to hell. So the point is, if you admit the road to hell is a real danger, then you have to start saying, as desirable as it is for the government to run our health care system, these, and for the government to ensure nursing home care for elderly people and pensions and Social Security, as desirable as all these things are, we've got to do something drastic. We either cut these entitlements, and by the way, the SIBO publishes every year a whole list of potential cuts, ways of doing something about it, or we need to raise taxes on the middle class. The rich simply, we can't just tax the rich. That's the other unpleasant prospect that Krugman would have to face. People of limited means will also have to pay 30% and 40% more. We do have to go the way of the small welfare states. In Sweden. By the way, that's another point. You know, the SIBO is projecting 29%, that the budget is going to be 29% of GDP in 30 years, up from 21% now. So you might say, well, what's wrong with that? All we have to do is tax everybody the way people are taxed in these small homogeneous, you know, states like Sweden and Denmark. It's obviously going to be devastating if we do it, but that's also a potential solution. In any case, I think that's essentially the problem with Krugman. All it boils down to is that if you're in your 40s, you have to start prudently planning for your old age. You know, if you're not fantastically wealthy, if just an ordinary person, prudently putting money away and stop borrowing in a profligate way. And I'm sure that's what Krugman started doing for himself, but he doesn't see that the analogy holds for the U.S. For the elder care entitlement programs as well.
Well, Gene, let it not be said that on this show we do nothing but talk about problems. We do offer solutions. It's that nobody ever takes us up on them.
Well, solutions. Okay. Again, I think that the potential solution is I was persuaded by my firebrand son Jim, who is now believes that the blockchain technology is so good and that in any rational now or irrational world the currencies of the world are going to stumble, the dollar is going to stumble one way or the other, and the new deal is that people won't have to the virtual currencies will be a safe haven and that the world will operate more rationally. It's depressing to recognize that the only way to unseat a currency, because indeed it's a great convenience, and you, by the way, of course, have said, you know, look, Bitcoin baffles me. The dollars, those smackers, as you like to point it, those smackers are just easy for simple-minded people like you and me to deal with. But there could be problems with those smackers down the road, and then the Bitcoin technology and Bitcoin may not last, and there may be other. That may be just the first pass. Those currencies make more sense, and they probably are the currencies of the future. That's the optimistic scenario, which might, I think, arise from the fiscal crisis of the state that the SIBO keeps warning about.
All right. Well, there it is. What is there? What can I link to? I mean, I could link to the CBO thing itself, but your Barron's columns might be behind a paywall.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, you guys, of course, you know, I've been a pain in the butt for you guys, for you in this regard. I know you put, you know, the last time you put the columns I wrote you, you put one of my columns in a special link. You know, I sent you my past column in excerpts, and I know somehow you managed to create a link for them. You remember that, Tom? You did that?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I don't know. If you did it once, you could probably do it again. I put out my special link. I wanted to finish, by the way. Yeah, if you want to shut me up, that's good. I wanted to go back to, you know, what's a good Keynesian, what's a bad Keynesian? The good Keynesians are the people who drank the Kool-Aid. They do believe, of course, that in recession, the government has got to run deficits. But they also believe that when there's an expansion, the government should either balance the budget or even run surpluses. And you know, through the 50s and in, even into the 60s, you did have that. By and large, there weren't recurrent deficits. But, of course, the good Keynesians are naive, and what they don't recognize is that this is music to politicians' ears when you tell them that spending can often be a good thing. And of course, the politicians want to please the electorate and not tax so much, although, of course, they want to tax the rich but not the middle class. And so, inevitably, by the 1970s, you began to have chronic deficits. And that was, you know, those of us who understand that that politicians can often be responsible and not behave like good Keynesians, the deficits began. And we had a brief, amazing moment in the late 1990s under Bill Clinton when we were suddenly getting a balanced budget and fiscal surpluses. But that was a – and by the way, see, lucky – it's interesting just to point out the lucky accidents that happened. The reason for those surpluses was mainly, first, that the Cold War abruptly ended and that even Bush, even the George H.W. Bush and Clinton government had to retrench a bit from all this Cold War spending, and they did close domestic bases. They did have to retrench on military spending because it would have been somewhat embarrassing if they were spending as much after the Soviet Union unraveled and after the Cold War ended. So defense spending, which was pretty bloated, actually sank a little bit in absolute terms and rose much more slowly than GDP. The second thing that happened to Clinton, which is very lucky, is that Hillary Care, that was, you know, Hillary Clinton's and Bill Clinton's version of Medicare, of Obamacare, rather, got soundly defeated. Had he been able to pass Hillary Care, no doubt the surpluses wouldn't have happened. So the defeat helped Clinton. And then the booming stock market gave him a huge amount of capital gains from revenues. And suddenly Clinton started to claim credit for this and became a fiscal conservative and talked about the locked box, talked about, so, you know, there are ironies in history. Certainly Clinton and then Gore became fiscal conservatives. Whether they really would have followed through on the idea of keeping the surpluses and planning for the future, all of that talk, the baby boom will become the baby boom time bomb. Clinton was talking in those terms. Now, then, of course, George W. Bush ignored him and passed a new entitlement, Medicare Part D, the drug benefit, ratcheted up defense spending. There were tax cuts that I think hurt. And then, of course, Obama came along, and now we're back on the trajectory that we've been on before. But the good Keynesians, of course, like the SIBO, believe, while I think they're wrong, they believe that fiscal deficits are good in recession. They at least acknowledge it, as the SIBO does, that if you run chronic deficits and if the debt continues to accumulate, then that it becomes a bad thing suddenly. That's what good Keynesians are willing to acknowledge, like the SIBO is. Now, the bad Keynesians, like Krugman, remain in denial about it, even when the government runs chronic deficits all the time in good times and bad. Even when that happens, they still hold on to the old theology. They say that it's all a great thing. But of course, as the SIBO points out, the bad news for people like Krugman and for the good Keynesians is that once you're at a debt to GDP ratio of 150% and 160%, you no longer even have much of an option to start running huge increase in deficits, because your deficits are already so large because the interest rates, the cost of servicing that debt is so huge. And so Krugman even ought to acknowledge that, you know, the old deficit financing fix is no longer going to work, 20, 30 years from now, because the debt will be so burdensome. So again, that's my little take on, again, I'm quoting a Keynesian organization, the Congressional Budget Office, but at least they're good Keynesians. They can see reality and they can understand that chronic deficits are not the original way for the good Keynesian policy to be pursued.
All right, and with that, we'll leave it here, and
sure.
with our great thanks to you for covering this,
because
I've been meaning to get to it, and I keep hearing people like Krugman say, "Oh, this is just a lot of scaremongering," and not like that makes me rethink what my view is, but I'm just wondering how we've answered that, and you showed it.
The road to hell is not inevitable. The road to serfdom was not inevitable. It's just too much of a worry, too much of a concern to be ignored. We've got to do something about it. And if we don't, then it's up for grabs about what's really going to happen.
Right, right. Okay, Gene, thanks so much again. Always a pleasure.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All right, I know I kept you guys a bit long today, but do not turn this off. But don't turn the show off after the interview portion. You miss all the goodies, right? You miss all. I'm giving away goodies all the time in this final portion, but here's one you're going to find interesting. Just to put an exclamation mark after the diversity in the Tom Woods Show audience, okay? Not bean counting diversity, real diversity. Because here's a website created by a listener that has nothing to do with anything you would expect. It's about artificial intelligence. And the site is maestroai.com. And when you go there and you get to that initial page of the site, it says that this project that the site is describing is an attempt at creating a generalized sensory motor inference engine. That is to say, a system that explores its environment all on its own to learn how the environment works. Once it's learned how the environment works, it can manipulate that environment any way you like. It can learn to do anything. It's essentially generalized machine learning. So it's a very interesting project. I know I have some, is the word nerd? Is the word geek? I'm not really sure what exactly the word is. And on this show, it's not, that word is not a put down. Whichever one you're talking about, that is not a put down. We embrace these words because we, people who were made fun of in school, we're the ones who make the world go round. So we embrace these words. But I urge you to check this out. It's very interesting. MaestroAI.com. Link to it at TomWoods.com/891 is the listener website mentioned. You can get nice publicity like this plus several other really valuable goodies that will send you a nice opening flood of traffic when you start your website. But before you get your hosting, get the deal. Find out exactly how to get all these bonuses from me. Check them out at TomWoods.com/publicity. All right, if all goes well, Michael Malice returns to the show tomorrow. We're going to talk about the situation in North Korea. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.